to case 2, which is Backwater Incorporated versus Penn America, appeal number 05-2805. Mr. Etzler.
Good morning, Your Honors. My name is Gordon Etzler, attorney from Valparaiso, Indiana, representing the Finkies. And with me is Mr. Tim Sindak, who assisted on the preparation of this brief. And I'm going to take 10 minutes of my time, reserve 5 minutes for Mr. Sindak on his response. And I believe the schedule doesn't show it that way. Your Honor, the issue in this case is whether or not the trial itself was conducted in a manner which provided a fair and just result to the parties and preserved the integrity of the legal process. In this particular case, it involved a business property that was damaged by an act of vandalism by unknown people. The insurance company provided insurance for casualty, of which the act was an insured occurrence under the policy. Proceedings were had in the matter, including a jury trial, which
ended in. What did the jury decide here? I just saw these unsigned general verdict forms in the appendix.
Your Honor, I was not involved in the trial, so I can't tell you why those were unsigned. I'm not even sure they were submitted to the jury
The verdict form that's in the appendix is we find for the plaintiff or we find for the defendant. That seems sort of unusual to submit a case like this to a jury with that sort of a general verdict form.
I think, illustrative of a number of procedures that which were undertaken in this case.
Well, was there a request to have more specific jury instructions in an interrogatory form? Was there a request for that?
No, there was not.
By either side?
By either side. The instructions were prepared by the magistrate and submitted to the parties, and they, in fact, did approve them.
That's such an odd way to try a jury trial.
It is.
Who wins? The jury goes back and decides who wins, the plaintiff or the defendant, without telling us, was there a fraud? Was there who set the fire? Who did the vandalism? And I just don't understand that.
I believe that the process was confusing in that there was a motion for summary judgment that had been filed almost a year before the trial, and it was briefed, I believe, through December of that year, and trial was had in May. The decision on a motion for summary judgment was not rendered until just a couple weeks before the trial. There was a motion in limine then that was filed commensurate with the decision of the court on a motion for summary judgment, and then trial was had.
Right, but none of that precludes having jury instruction. I mean, having verdict forms that are in an interrogatory format so that we know what the basis of the verdict is. None of that precludes that, because you had a clear ruling on summary judgment. The bad faith couldn't come in. So, I mean,
it was a very confusing matter because of the lateness and the way the opinion was prepared on the motion for summary judgment. And the way the motion limine was prepared, I believe that there was a lot of confusion by everyone, including the court, who I thought bought into that.
I don't understand all this confusion.
The
insurance company took the position. Maybe I'm wrong, and you guys know this case better than I do, but I thought the insurance company took the position they're not paying up because they think the policyholders were complicit in the vandalism that caused the loss. So why doesn't the jury that's trying this case, trying that issue, decide by the preponderance of the evidence whether they're correct?
I think that that's what the insurance company did, was tried that issue. However, there was a preliminary instruction.
What issue was tried in front of the jury? That's the issue.
It's hard to really understand what was tried because of the preliminary instruction that was issued, which put so much emphasis on the whole trial and tainted the whole trial proceedings that there was an increase in the insurance coverage just days before the act.
That's always usually relevant in one of these cases.
Right. It is.
Somebody pops their doubles their insurance, and then a couple of days later there's a loss under the policy. That's always an issue.
Except in this case, Your Honor, that instruction was flawed because it did not permit any understanding that if you had a good business purpose for increasing the coverages, for example, like in this case where there was purchased about $130,000 worth of lighting equipment just weeks before, and which triggered then the inquiry by the Finkies to make sure that they had coverage. Finding out that they did not have adequate coverage, they did not understand the differences between actual cash value and replacement cost value. Finding out later on that, in fact, the name of the insured on the policy itself was confusing in that they couldn't tell, although Mr. and Mrs. Finke were the owner of the real estate, it was confusing in the policies whether or not the Finkies themselves were insureds or just their company. In addition, there was a lot of confusion about whether or not Ruth Finke was caught up, who has individual rights, was caught up in this allegation that Mr. Finke was somehow involved in the vandalism.
Was there any testimony? I know that the magistrate judge granted a motion in limine about certain statements made to Finke by the insurance agent. Is that what is that the light situation you're talking about, the installation light? Did anything come in as to why there was an increase in the insurance? Was any evidence admitted?
Yes, there was.
And what was that evidence?
Mr. Finke, on his testimony, they tried to bring in the testimony of his conversations with his insurance agent, the independent insurance agent, represented him and represented the insurance company, about the conversations they had about being underinsured.
And was that related to the lights? Is that what you're talking about?
That was one of the things that occurred because they had done some remodeling in this business.
Right, and what I want to know is what evidence came in to explain why there was an increase in the insurance? Did the magistrate bar everything? I want to know if any evidence came in, and tell me what is the evidence that came in?
There was no evidence that came in about those conversations, about the reason for having the increase in insurance to go from a cash value to the replacement value and to have increased coverage for the increased property that was on the premises. Increasing the policy limits, I think controls on whether or not there's a business purpose. that there's a business purpose, you cannot draw the innuendos and the inferences that the insurance company based their laundry list of factors about why they felt Mr. Finke was implicit in this matter.
Well, there was lots of other evidence that the insurance company offered.
There were circumstances where the insurance company then proffered inferences of their own with no evidence whatsoever to meet those inferences. For example, they said that if a person increases the coverage on their insurance policy, that if there's a loss, it is to be presumed, practically presumed, that the insured was the cause of the loss in some manner. And you don't even have to prove it. And that's what they said. We don't even have to prove it in this case. The report was made to the police department about that they thought that there were employees involved.
Well, let me go
Nothing
back to that first point. Well, you were saying that was there a jury instruction offered saying that as a matter of law, proof was required?
The instructions were prepared by the magistrate.
And did the magistrate bar the parties from submitting further instructions?
No, he did invite.
And nobody objected to his instructions. So
he did invite.
And nobody
those.
Offered any further instructions. So
that's right.
Are we in a waiver? I mean, that's a problem for you. If you're now saying there was an error of law and that presumption shouldn't have been there, somebody should have submitted an instruction.
That's true. But the basis of our appeal is on the plain error doctrine, and we believe that there are exceptional circumstances in this case where that doctrine should apply.
But there's so much evidence here for the jury to glop onto. Business was losing a little money. Insurance was increased. Something about the alarm? Wasn't the alarm disconnected or something or disabled?
I'm running out of time.
Somebody inside had to...
These things, an ordinary business person would do in a prudent running of his business. He would make inquiries and do certain things.
But an alarm system. How about Finke called the alarm company 3 days before the vandalism to inquire on whether the company could monitor precisely when someone entered and left the building? Or that he and his daughter were the only ones that knew the code and had keys to the club and the alarm didn't go off that night. Or that he was the last person in the building before the vandalism occurred. Or the fact that there were 48 monitored cameras, none of them were on the night of it. And the cooking that took place during the vandalism. And the vandals were inside the club for several hours.
Those are statements.
And Finke also installed the security system. I mean, these were facts that were not even disputed in the summary judgment motion.
They are disputed. Mr. Finke was in Cleveland at the time, and he regularly, routinely, made calls about who was in and out. There were some difficulties with employees, and he did that as a matter of course. That was not an unusual step that he took in making a call. I really want to reserve some time on rebuttal, if I may.
Okay.
Thank you.
Is Mr. Sendak going to argue now, or are you going to come up later?
Rebuttal.
In a rebuttal, sir.
All right.
Good morning, may it please the court. My name is Mike Brown. I'm an attorney from Indianapolis. I represent Penn America Insurance Company in this case. I was present at trial, was trial counsel during the proceedings.
Why did the case go to the jury on a general verdict?
To be candid with Your Honor, no one requested otherwise. I've tried cases in federal courts for 25 years, and in first-party property cases like this, this is the type of verdict form we've always used. The jury was instructed specifically. They needed to decide whether this was an actual vandalism by someone else or property damaged by the insured. It was a yes or no question, and they were given a simple form that said either fine for the plaintiff or fine for the defendant. I don't think there was any
confusion.
Those
verdicts are, those verdict forms are the easiest for the lawyers and judges mm-hmm. before trial. But after trial, then the problem is trying to figure out what the heck the jury was mm-hmm. telling us here.
Well, I think in this instance, the issue that was presented to the jury was very simple, and it was one specific issue, and that was the only issue they were to decide, which is, did Backwater have an involvement in causing this particular loss? And the evidence that was presented all focused on that particular question, and the jury gave what we believe is a correct answer based on the evidence that was presented to them. And to suggest that there's some fundamental unfairness and injustice, was trial conducted in a manner to provide a fair result and preserve the integrity of the legal process? I candidly haven't attended a trial that was a more civil and more respectful and more well-run trial in many years. And that's with all due respect to Judge Cherry and Kevin Steele, who tried it for the plaintiff. Judge Cherry made every effort and an excellent effort, in my opinion, to be very straight down the middle and fair in this case, and to take issues which were not disputed and suggest now that he somehow should have been acting differently, I think,
I'm not offensive. Suggesting that the judge
I'm talking about the different. Plaintiff's case here,
okay.
Here, the appellant's position. Yeah. The issues that the appellant had raised, of course, it does attack the granting a partial summary judgment. Judge Williams has done a nice job of laying out exactly what we presented. We thought that the plaintiff's task in responding to the summary judgment was to come forward and say, no, that's not a letter that was sent, or that's not something that the insurance agent said, or that's not something that the adjuster said. They didn't do that. They accepted the fact that that the company had asked for an exam under oath and waited almost a half a year to get it, and another 3 months to get the examination for Mrs. Finke. They didn't dispute that evidence. And so Judge Cherry was in a position where he had undisputed term of dealing with this case and an undisputed term of the facts of the case, and made what I believe to be a completely appropriate decision that this company had a right to litigate the question of whether or not there was vandalism. He starts right out in his opinion saying, company's not asking me to grant summary judgment on breach of contract. That's going to get decided by a jury sometime later. They're asking me to decide whether they have enough evidence to justify their denial of the claim, and I believe that they do.
Let me just ask you about some evidence the magistrate didn't allow in. I mean, one of your big points was this coverage was this additional coverage was purchased right before this vandalism, and that was a big issue in the case. And yet the plaintiffs, because you objected, were not allowed to put in evidence as to why they purchased this. I mean, that to me is unfair.
There's 2 points that I would like to make.
Why wouldn't that be relevant?
It was relevant if properly presented. We didn't object to Mr. Finke testifying as to his reasons, and in fact, Mr. Finke did testify to his reasons in detail. All we objected to was to Mr. Finke saying what the insurance agent told him, because it was hearsay. And that insurance agent was on our witness list and testified in the case and was asked, why did you call Mr. Finke and suggest this? What conversations did you have with Mr. Finke about increasing the insurance? And the agent testified, well, I understood they'd made repairs to the building. I understand they'd added equipment to the building. He testified to that. All of that was presented to the jury. I think on the specific question, did you call Mr. Finke and suggest this, he said he didn't remember who initiated the contact one way or the other. But the purpose of our objection to that one question, to Mr. Finke testifying to what the agent said, was so that the agent would be the one that testified to his own words, and we would be in a position to cross-examine that testimony as to that agent. But there wasn't a failure of that evidence to be offered in the case. As far as the preliminary instruction is concerned, the plaintiff's own contentions in the case, filed in the final pretrial order, emphasized that the insurance had been increased. I think from his perspective, from counsel's perspective, he wanted the jury to understand we have a substantial loss here. And in fact, Mr. Hoffman also testified that the damages were $1.4 million. So it demonstrated we needed this increase because we had this much stuff and we were going to have this much damage if we didn't have it. This jury clearly understood that there was a reason to increase it. But the point remains, even if they had all of those things, why suddenly decide to do it right then? It was a legitimate question for the jury to consider. And the idea that we said there was a presumption, I'm not sure where that comes from. I know of no place in the record anywhere where we said or the judge said or anybody said there was a presumption. It was just one piece of the whole picture that the jury was allowed to consider. And the fact that it was increased was admitted. That's all the judge referenced in the preliminary instruction. Why it was increased was up to the presentation of evidence. Mr. Finke testified to it. Mrs. Finke also testified to the purchase of items during the course of their operation of the
business. I don't understand even why Finke couldn't testify to the conversation with the agent, because didn't that go to his state of mind? I mean, it could have come in for non-hearsay purposes.
Well, it could be.
Well,
that
in order to explain, you know, why he responded or why he acted in a certain way. I understand, though, you're saying that the agent took the stand so they were fully able to ask questions of the agent on that.
And our position at the time was that it certainly would have been feasible for plaintiff's counsel to say, Judge, I would offer this with a limiting instruction to the jury that it's not being offered for the truth that there was actually a necessity of an increase, but only that the agent said this to me. That wasn't done. In fact, there was no offer to proof, so we don't actually know what Mr. Finke might have said. As to the issue of Mrs. Finke, I'm not sure what the court's being asked to do. Before the case went to trial, Mrs. Finke dismissed her claim voluntarily. In a stipulation of dismissal, which is document 49 in the record, and document 50 is the granting of that motion to dismiss her claim. So at the time this case went to trial, Mrs. Finke had no claim. Plaintiffs are not challenging that dismissal. They're not saying that the court shouldn't have granted a voluntary stipulation of dismissal. So I'm not sure how we're in a position to address in any way whether Mrs. Finke had a separate claim that she could have addressed, because she dismissed any such cause of action. There certainly can be no error on the trial court's part in not dealing with issues that are not before it at the time the case goes to trial. But the primary point would be the Liggett case to which they refer is a homeowner's case. Tenants by entireties owning a home, both named as insured on a homeowner's policy. That's not this case. This is a commercial case where Backwater Incorporated is the named insured. Mr. and Mrs. Finke are listed as additional insureds for purposes of liability they might have, might arise out of a slip and fall or some other thing that happens at the bar, but they're not additional insureds on the property coverage. Perfectly appropriate. In their agreement with Backwater, Backwater agrees to get the insurance. Backwater has an insurable interest in the property, and Backwater buys insurance to take care of that insurable interest that they have. And it was stipulated in the pretrial order, again, which is document 46, I believe, in the record, that Penn America would pay Backwater if there was a judgment by the jury. It wouldn't raise any issues that Mr. and Mrs. Finke weren't insured, but that they would pay Backwater, Inc., if there was a claim, and that Backwater was bound by the acts of its officers and directors. And that was part of the stipulation that they entered into in this case, and that the jury was advised that based on that the corporation is bound by the acts of its officers and directors. They were the officers and directors of the corporation. Mr. Finke was an officer and director. Mrs. Finke was an officer and a director. They're bound by their actions, and Backwater was the claimant, and Backwater presented that claim. As far as the presentation of the trial itself, I'm not sure where the concept originates, some overlook to see whether that was a fair trial. As best I can tell, they're really just pointing back at the other issues and saying all these other issues add up. What I would suggest to the court is that in this case, the plaintiff at the last minute came up with an expert, and that expert wasn't a qualified expert, in my opinion, and I moved to prevent that witness from being allowed to testify. He had no credentials. He hadn't seen the building when the injury occurred. He'd been in there 3 years after it occurred in whatever condition it was in at that point in time. Judge Cherry allowed that witness to testify. If Judge Cherry had some great animus and some great desire to move this case in favor of my insurance company, it would have granted that motion, and it wouldn't have allowed that witness to testify. I think as the court looks at the record, it'll see there were many other instances where the court denied objections that we made and allowed the plaintiff to do things that it wanted to do that were contrary to the company's position. Our simple position in this case is the jury was called. They were given all the facts that were admissible. They were given all the facts the plaintiff's lawyer chose to give them. They were given all the facts that the court allowed us to give them, and it made its decision. And to undermine that decision based on issues that were not preserved as error at trial and which, at best, nip around the edges of the real question, which was what happened in that building on that night, is unfair to that jury and unfair to Judge Cherry and certainly wouldn't be advancing the cause of justice. Thank you.
Thank you. Mr. Sendak.
Your Honor, may it please the court. I first want to make it clear that until just now, nobody had used the word animus about anybody, and we're certainly not accusing the court below of any animus towards anyone, including our clients. What our whole point is that there are several key places that took place in reviewing or in this trial by review of the record that all point to the fact that some key evidence was excluded, and all of that from the point of the summary judgment to the point of the final instructions work to, in essence, deny our client the full day in court to put in all of the evidence. Some of the key evidence that counsel calls hearsay, we don't think is hearsay at all. We think those are words spoken. We think those go to the heart of the matter. If those jury instructions were that important, and those were the first in the order of giving those instructions, that's the first instruction that the jury was given about the operative facts of the case, a defense. And the same, to rub it in the final instructions, same order, a defense. Isn't that a little backwards? Okay, well, maybe we put an instruction out of order. Maybe that's harmless error. I'm not sure. But it sure is an important one, especially when evidence is excluded.
Of course, the court was given no theory like state of mind as to a way to get the evidence in. And do you agree, as counsel pointed out, the insurance agent did have an opportunity to testify and was questioned. And the standard for hearsay is not just the fact that words were spoken. You know, it has to be admissible. You know, I understand that it was offered, but there was no offer of proof. There was no why doesn't come in for state of mind.
I can't explain to you what the heat of the moment.
You agree that the insurance agent testified.
Yes.
And he was cross-examined on his conversations that he had with.
But it occurs to me in reviewing the record that what Mr. Finke heard the insurance agent said is critical and goes to his state of mind. And that is a critical difference. And the fact, not the truth of what was said or wasn't, or was omitted, but the fact that the words were spoken is a critical part of this evidence which was kept from the jury.
There was never really any follow-up to try
right.
to get this back in. Right?
I know.
And that's the problem.
Mm-hmm. The problem
Most
is...
Most lawyers think if you get a hearsay objection sustained, you just kind of rephrase the question, you dance around, and pretty soon you get it in anyhow.
I know, and I don't have an explanation for the court of why that wasn't pursued, other than I wasn't trial counsel, and I didn't make that tactical decision at that particular time. But nevertheless, and that's why we're looking at the whole thing here, and that's why we think it's plain error, because this evidence, irrespective of whether trial counsel made a mistake, the fact is that some crucial evidence was kept from the jury.
Well, the evidence came in through the insurance agent himself.
Mm-hmm.
So what is the harm? Is there any reason to suspect that Mr. Finke heard something other than what the insurance agent testified he said?
Well, that depends upon whether you want to hear both parties to the conversation.
Well, he testified about his end of the conversation. The plaintiff did.
No.
Right?
I beg to differ. He was prevented from testifying what the insurance salesman told him.
But he testified about what he himself said in the conversation.
Yes.
And the agent testified about what he said, and the jury can put the two
yes.
together.
Yes.
Mm-hmm.
Yes.
So what's
but
the
he,
harm?
But he wasn't allowed to testify. Mr. Finke wasn't allowed to testify about what he thought the insurance salesman told him. And I believe that's crucial.
But is there any reason to think that that was something different from what
yes.
the insurance agent said?
I think there certainly could be. I can't stand up here and testify for Mr. Finke, and it isn't appropriate for me to do so. But I think certainly people hear different things different ways. And there was no reason to keep that out. There was every reason to put it in.
But, of course, since we didn't have an offer of proof, we don't. None of us know what he would have said.
Agreed.
Because you didn't really advance that in your brief, what he would have said.
I agree. But under the doctrine of plain error, eventually there becomes a point where it's so obvious that it's error that the judge is a lawyer, too, and knows that. And to keep the trial fair, you have to bring those things in. I realize we have an adversary system.
But then the judge would have to be clairvoyant to know what's on the mind of Finke. I mean, a judge has to rule on what's presented before the court. And if counsel doesn't give the court a clue as to what the testimony would be, how's the judge to know?
Well, I think opinion is that the ruling was erroneous because I don't think it was hearsay or even met the definition of hearsay. Didn't even come close. And when combined with the obvious error in those instructions and not being allowed to fully give evidence as to the import of those instructions, it seems to me, created error that is not harmless.
We'll take the case under advisement. Case 3 for